You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 92. On the last show, we visited with Joseph Makos and learned about the incredible collection of 30,000 historic New Orleans newspapers that he stumbled upon after answering a Craigslist ad in 2013. That collection's now become part of the NOLA DNA project, and it'll enable historians, authors, journalists, and many others to delve into our past history in amazing ways. I had a great time talking with Joseph, and I know you'll enjoy the discussion too. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. Today's episode is about Airbnb and short-term rentals in New Orleans and the impact on the city. The idea for this episode came from a thread in our Facebook group community, Beyond Bourbon Street Crew, K-R-E-W-E, when I realized visitors don't often think about the impact their decisions make when they choose to come to New Orleans. All right, with that, let's jump into today's discussion. As I mentioned, this is going to be all about the impact of Airbnb and short-term rentals in New Orleans. My guest today is a reporter who covers New Orleans politics for NOLA.com. He's also a New Orleanian now who lives in the heart of the city in an area that's felt the impact of the short-term rental boom. Welcome to the show, Mr. Kevin Litton. Kevin, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. As I mentioned, you're a reporter and a journalist with NOLA.com, and you cover, among other things, politics in New Orleans. You've written extensively and covered a lot about this topic, and so I thought you'd be a great resource for us. But before we get into that, let's talk just a little bit about your background. So you're a relatively new New Orleanian, but where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Silver Spring. See, my grandparents weren't born in New Orleans, so I'm not allowed to be a New Orleans resident because my grandparents or my great-grandparents aren't from here. But that's cool. I'm happily a transplant. Got here about 3 years ago, and I've been covering New Orleans politics for all that time. And before that, I covered state politics in Baton Rouge. Did some commercial real estate reporting in Baltimore and started my career in Connecticut, which was like my first job out of college. But I'm originally from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Yeah, so we spent 8 years in Northern Virginia working in the district, so familiar with that. You know, my feeling as a native New Orleanian is that native New Orleanians make way too big a deal about that. I think new New Orleanians, and to me that means maybe people who weren't born here, add so much character and flavor. And my personal bias is, who are we to say that, well, because we were born here, the city has always been about transplants, and that kind of gets to what we're going to talk about today, but about the culture is so rich here because of all the people that have come here, right? And I think that, frankly, post-Katrina, one of the positives, if you're looking for a positive, is so many people came with different perspectives and backgrounds. So by my take, you live in the city, you're a New Orleanian. Don't let anybody tell you different.
Thanks. I mean, you spend any time in New Orleans cemeteries, and if you start researching where the people that are buried in the cemeteries are from, there are so many great stories about people that are not from here. And some of them that were trying to fit in and didn't, and maybe got mad about it and built a gigantic monument to get back at everybody. But, you know, those are some of the great stories that I think makes New Orleans what it is. But, you know, I cover New Orleans city council hearings, and short-term rentals have taken up a ton of time over the past couple of years. And I always find it remarkable when people, the first thing that they say when they get up on the mic is, born and raised in New Orleans. Maybe they'll mention their high school. But it's always something about, hey, I've got a little bit more credibility here because I'm from here. And in the short-term rental debate, it actually makes a lot of sense because that outside investment thing has really been a controversial thing about short-term rentals. Are you here because you want to be here? Or are you here because you're buying a piece of property that you want to turn into a mini hotel in the middle of somebody's neighborhood, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that one statement kind of cuts to it, right? New Orleans is a place where residents are proud of their history, are proud of their neighborhoods. New Orleans very much is a collection of neighborhoods, especially before Katrina. People just didn't move out of their neighborhoods, would spend their whole lives and really not go very far away from there. And so there's a strong sense of identity and culture about neighborhoods. And I think that as we get into this, that's one of the things that, again, it's like any place, respecting the culture, respecting, you know, the kind of traditions. And also, I think, understanding change happens. So let's talk just a little bit broadly, if we can, about Do you know about when short-term rentals and Airbnb really kind of became a thing in New Orleans?
You could probably trace it to the beginning of the platforms, because Airbnb really stormed onto the scene along with a lot of these technology companies that started disrupting in lots of different ways. Media, tourism is a huge one. And Airbnb coming onto the scene made people realize that, hey, I can rent out a room. That was how Airbnb first pitched it, right?
Yeah. They
were like, I'm going to share my house with somebody. But I think it very quickly became a big thing in New Orleans when people realized how much money there was in it. I mean, we have the tourism numbers speak for themselves. If you look at the number of tourism visits that we're getting over the years, they go up and up as the city gets stronger and stronger and becomes really a destination, which I think it always has been. But I think after Katrina, when people realized New Orleans wasn't going away and the culture was here to stay. And then also I think there's a huge thing. It's a pull that can be good for residents to draw new residents that want authenticity, but tourists also want authenticity. And if they live in a bland place that doesn't have authenticity, that doesn't have the culture that New Orleans has, of course it seems like a wonderful place to visit. I think also the strength of cities nationwide has really helped New Orleans, because people have realized that they can visit New York or Philadelphia or some of the other nation's great cities and realize that there is an amazing, it's safe, first of all. Mm-hmm. Cities have gotten safer. Cities have gotten more vibrant. Cities have drawn more young people to them in the last decade. And so New Orleans has benefited from that, but people's realization that cities were a great destination for a visit, and not just the beach or the Bahamas or Europe, for example. You could go to a great American city and have a great vacation too. Along with that comes the technology platform. People realize, hey, I can stay in a place, going back to that authenticity, I can stay in a neighborhood instead of on Canal Street. We could go back into some of the history of tourism in New Orleans and look at the French Quarter. And the French Quarter felt this pull in the 1950s and 1960s, when a lot of really important property in French Quarter was getting snapped up by people who wanted to build hotels, and they realized that people wanted that authentic feel and that authentic experience that the French Quarter drew. So I think, to get back to your question, it really did start with the platforms, but I think there's a lot of historic pull in that authenticity and that historic flavor that like was happening alongside it that made people realize, hey, this is a great city to visit, and my visit's going to be that much better if I can stay in a great neighborhood.
Sure. That's a really insightful point. As you're talking, I'm thinking about, we did an episode with Richard Campanella about the history of Bourbon Street. And of course, he's written a whole book about that. And he talks about the fact that Bourbon Street, until the 50s, 60s, was really just a residential street. You know, as you get close to Canal Street, it had some of the commercial stuff it still has. But in many cases, it goes all the way back to the end of Storyville, and the city sort of shutting down Storyville, but still wanting a center of commerce and a place to sort of cut up and music and all of that. And that tension sort of from that time forward has always been there. And to your point, if you wander through the French Quarter, if you're heading downriver towards Esplanade, about the point that you cross St. Anne's, kind of behind the cathedral, it starts to get very, very residential, right? As opposed to the closer you go to Canal Street, it's more touristy and more, neon, and then some of the sort of less seemly parts of the neighborhood. But that's right. I think there's probably always been a tension. I think added to it post-Katrina, you had the destruction in the city, and that caused a crunch on rentals. So the rental market here was always pretty affordable. New Orleans has traditionally been a place where the median income isn't very high. The poverty levels are high. And so you had a lot of people dependent on rent. You also had people in neighborhoods where the houses were almost passed down from generation to generation. And all of that gets wiped out. Many people can't come back. Then when you can come back, there's a shortage of housing and rentals. And then not that long after that, you're right, the platforms and technology start to hit in general. So it's kind of a perfect storm, if you will, of all those things coming together. I think also your point about tourism is right, that, gosh, the podcast, the tagline is an insider's guide to New Orleans. And what people want these days when they visit cities is that sort of curated off the beaten path. And what better way to do that than to experience a neighborhood, right? So that comes about, and it did feel like, I'm with you, early on, the idea was to rent somebody's extra bedroom. My neighbor rents an extra bedroom, and I think that's a perfect. She's a retiree. She can make a little bit of money. She can have a house guest. Not a big deal.
And there's a long tradition in New Orleans of during large events, Mardi Gras, Jazz Fest are the two big ones, that people would put their rental probably in classified ads to start.
Sure.
Craigslist later, and then Airbnb comes along. But that's a long tradition going here that if you were going to be out of town and you wanted to make an extra buck,
right,
nobody would fault you for that.
No, it's a good point, right? Like lots of families leave Mardi Gras week, right? And so you're right, probably, gosh, all my life I've known families that would rent out, usually to, you know, friends or whatever, or swap a house or rent. And so you're right, the platform might be new, but the concept is far from it.
Well, if you're looking to do economic development, you always want to grow, right? Mm-hmm. And the only way to grow tourism in New Orleans is to make it a year-round business, to make it, I mean, there's so many festivals here. It's when they add a new festival, I'm like, how did they find a weekend for it, right?
Exactly.
That was the growth that was going alongside a lot of this, was that how do we find a way to get people here year-round? How do we find it outside of Jazz Fest and Mardi Gras? Those are our peak times. We're only going to be able to host that many people. And then you start getting in All-Star Weekend. You start getting in Super Bowl. Okay, wow, that's a huge driver. People realize this. But wait, can we do it year-round? And I think the platforms really helped enable that because you could book things so far in advance.
Sure.
And it was an alternative to the hotel. You know, maybe on All-Star Weekend, when things are going crazy in the city, maybe it would be nice to have an alternative to a busy hotel and be in a neighborhood that seemed a little bit quieter. But the consequence of that was that the neighborhoods started getting busy because of this too. And then the residents are like, well, wait a second, we didn't sign up for this. We didn't want to be in a busy hotel, which is what it started feeling like. I mean, there's so many residents that I've talked to, especially those that invested early in neighborhoods that were a little bit tougher to see what your return on the investment was going to be. I think the Bywater is a great example. Marigny is probably one as well, where people have been there for like 20 years and they're like, nobody had any interest in this place before Katrina. Now all of a sudden, all of our neighbors are gone because some investor swooped in, bought up a bunch of little houses and turned them into mini hotels.
Yeah, and I think you make a point, like sort of starting with the original neighborhood, the French Quarter, and then as you drift downriver into the Marigny and the Bywater, and then sort of back a town towards the lake, and you head into the Treme, those were all, the French Quarter was residential, but obviously had this commercial aspect, but the others really didn't. And you're right, people that bought before Katrina, you know, if you bought a property in the Marigny or the Bywater before Katrina, sometimes people would look at you and go, what are you doing? You know, is it safe? Is it this? Is it that? But there was very little commercial stuff back there. And now, if anything, it gets criticized for being too hipster-ish. And Frenchman Street, people will often say, oh, well, it's like the Bourbon Street of 30 years ago. I'm not quite sure that's fair, but that's what people say. But you're exactly right. People bought in for the charm and also the affordability. And then you had this issue where investors seemed to come in and just buy up a block. And so all of a sudden, you moved into what you believed was a neighborhood, and all of a sudden, it's not a neighborhood anymore. You don't have a community.
And I think that's been a criticism of the French Quarter, which was on a slow decline in terms of being a residential neighborhood for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the French Quarter has been bleeding residents forever. There's a ton of people that, even to this day, with a full ban on short-term rentals in the French Quarter, there's still a ton of just vacation homes, just people who have enough money that they love New Orleans. They love to hang out in the French Quarter, but they don't want to live there year-round. It's a noisy, busy neighborhood, right? But then that starts getting into the Marigny, the Bywater, and even the Treme, and it starts – those three neighborhoods have been so hard hit by short-term rentals. And when I say hard hit, all you need to do is look at Airbnb's website right now. There's a full ban on short-term rentals in the French Quarter, right? But there is no shortage of listings that say French Quarter. And then when you look into it, it's the Treme, it's the Marigny, it's the Bywater. It's something where you can say walking distance to the French Quarter because that's what everybody looks for. And that's fine from a tourism perspective, but from a neighborhood perspective, most people that I know that live in the Marigny, the Bywater, are not living there because they want to be close to the French Quarter. They're living there because it's a great neighborhood. It's truly a picturesque, wonderful neighborhood with housing stock that's unmatched in America, really.
Yeah.
That's great to see, but I talked to somebody that said, I thought this was really poignant, that she was sitting out on her porch one like summer evening and she's like, it's a Thursday night. Up here come the rolling suitcases, right? I can hear those wheels coming up the street. And somebody stops by and is like, you live here? Oh my God, you must be so lucky to live here. Look at this amazing neighborhood. And she's like, yeah. I mean, I lived here for 20 years. There's a reason I've stayed here, right? And when the person walked away, she said, I just felt like I was a prop to mm-hmm. them. And I think that's kind of tough. I'm lucky enough that I live in mid-city and it's not as hard hit by the short-term rentals, but certainly that whole thing does not happen every Thursday, Friday night in mid-city. I mean, I kind of know my neighbors, and reporting on this and talking to people who have been frustrated by short-term rentals, I can certainly understand their perspective when they feel like they don't know their neighbors anymore.
Yeah, and I think circling back to your point about the French Quarter, it felt that way, you know, exactly what you said. People with wealth would have a place and it would be vacant. So then when short-term rentals came into the market, they could look up and say, well, hey, I can make some money. I'm not going to be there much anyway. But then that happened, as you're describing, in the Marigny and the Bywater and the Treme. People started buying up in the French Quarter properties, a lot of property. So it does a couple things. The residents that were there that maybe had relatively affordable housing and provide the infrastructure for the tourism industry and, you know, the restaurants and the clubs, all of a sudden were getting forced out. Right. And then they have to live further away because, you know, a homeowner or a property owner says, well, I can make more money off the short term market. So you are inadvertently maybe ruining the culture in the neighborhood that was the charm or was the allure to begin with. And then I think you're right. As it crossed Esplanade and Rampart Street going into those three neighborhoods, that's where it was affordable, and you did have generations of New Orleanians living there, or maybe somebody that bought in and really wanted to be part of a community. And now all of a sudden, you know, you mentioned talking to people. I've talked to people sitting on front stoops who say, gosh, I feel like a concierge. You know, people are asking tourist questions, and I'm happy to help, but I used to enjoy sitting here having coffee with my neighbor who'd been there for 30 years. And that's gone.
Well, let me say something about the culture, because I think there is a valid concern that there's an erosion of cultural values that can be caused by tourism, and that when you displace people who are what are we often refer here to as culture bearers, who are from these important neighborhoods in New Orleans, if they don't have a place to live, yes, there is great potential for a culture to be eroded. But I will say, in the 4 years that I've been here, listening to all those concerns, the culture of New Orleans is very hard to stamp out. It's very hard. I mean, even after Katrina was like the biggest concern because there were so many people that were gone. But when you look at how culture rebounded here and how much it's still valued and how much music and amazing traditions are still alive here and how we're creating new ones still. I mean, that stuff is very much alive. I don't think that tourism has hurt that in a huge degree. There are a lot of equity concerns about how do second lines continue to function if there's not a lot of funding for them and just the neighborhoods have to fund them. I mean, that's not sustainable. I understand mm-hmm. that concern, mm-hmm. but I don't think that you can say short-term rentals eroded the culture of New Orleans as much as you could say, wait a second, if we're going to support all these tourists, where are the people going to live that can actually support this industry? I mean, these are not high-paying jobs.
Right.
People that run short-term rentals, they have to employ housekeepers. Those are not the highest rung on the totem pole in the tourism industry, right? And if those people can't live near where they work, what are we going to do?
Right. And you think, you know, for one, this is exactly why I wanted to speak to someone who covers it, and maybe a little less biased, because there are, it's not all bad. It's not all good. There are nuances to it. I think you, to your point, so there are more restaurants in the city now than there were before Katrina. By some estimates, it's somewhere between 1,100 and 1,500 or 1,600 restaurants. And if you talk to restaurateurs, one of the biggest challenges is finding people to work. And in part, when you start to pull that thread, it's exactly your point. Well, if people can't have a living wage, if they can't find a place to live close by, then they won't work. Well, then it starts to crumble the whole thing, right? But I think you make a great point that in many respects, I think the culture is every bit as vibrant and strong as it ever was before Katrina, and in many respects, stronger. Maybe because of Katrina, as much as New Orleanians always took great pride in our culture, it feels even more so. You know, and I think about a place like the Backstreet Cultural Museum in the Treme, a great sort of living legacy and tribute to the Mardi Gras Indian tradition. So it's not so clear cut. They probably get more traffic than they ever got because of some of the things we're talking about. And there's also tensions because of that. You know, perhaps people aren't living near there or feel priced out or those sorts of things. So it's definitely not a black and white kind of clear cut. This makes sense or it's terrible.
The point that I'm trying to make here is that I think that as this debate over short-term rentals has gotten more heated, that there has been a tendency to say short-term rentals are to blame for lots of different things, including eroding culture, including affordable housing, including all these things. And short-term rentals are probably a big piece of the affordable housing issue. I think it's hard to make the case that when you take whole homes off the market and make them into a commercial property, that they don't become out of reach for a residential owner. But at the same time, New Orleans has a bunch of issues, right? Poverty, unemployment, inequity. We've got a lot of stuff. I don't think you can look at short-term rentals and say this is the cause of everything. Mm-hmm. Now, as a tourist, if you want to ask yourself the question about whether or not you are contributing or making a healthy investment in your visit, you know, the residents here would say, yeah, don't load up a house with 15 people.
Right.
Make people sleep on the floor, party until all hours of the night, trash the neighborhood. There is a fair amount of that going on, and short-term rentals undoubtedly enabled a lot of that. And that is an issue. There's a whole quality of life element with short-term rentals that I think people absolutely understand. And if you talk to the industry and you talk to the people who've made money off of short-term rentals, they will even say, of course there's bad actors. Of course we don't want bad actors, but there's a lot of responsible operators here. But look, it's New Orleans. You'll find if you visit here, the city is not great in enforcing many things. I mean, they will say that you're not allowed to do this, but when you spend some time here, you find you're not allowed to do it, but you can do it.
Sure.
You know, and I think that probably extended to short-term rentals too. And that, if you're dealing with that on a weekly basis as a resident, right, and a long-term homeowner or even a short-term homeowner, that's tiresome.
Yeah.
That wears you down.
I think about as you're saying that when you go to Jazz Fest, particularly if you go in the back entrance off of Desai Boulevard, you'll see plenty of people allowing pay for parking on their driveways, on their front lawns, and their whatever, and you'll see people selling beer out of ice chests, right? And those things aren't permitted. They're not legal, and I think for the most part, the neighbors that don't do it say, it's Jazz Fest, it's two weekends a year, it's 8 days, whatever, you know, it's good. But if it was every day all of a sudden, those same neighbors would say, well, hang on a minute, you know, come on, Kevin, it's, you know, this is not a business, it's not a restaurant.
And this comes up with second lines, too. I mean, second lines basically go from, like, September to mid-June. We're still in second line season, even though it's really hot here. Well, a lot of these second lines go through the same neighborhoods, right?
Right.
They generate trash because it's a lot of people, it's a lot of drinking, it's a lot of partying, and the neighbors do get upset about that after a while. Now, these may not be neighborhoods where short-term rentals are hitting all the time, but these are certainly situations where people are going through neighborhoods, and it may just be for a few minutes, mm-hmm, for some loud music, but they leave stuff behind. And short-term rentals, very similar in the sense that the amount of trash that a weekend of partying at a bachelor pad can generate, and you multiply that for almost every weekend of the year, people get really sensitive about that stuff.
Yeah, I see sort of a different side of that. And again, this is maybe my native New Orleanian coming out. To me, the second line enriches the neighborhood. It's part of the culture. And if you sort of move into the neighborhood and don't understand that. I don't have a whole lot of tolerance for that. On the flip side, you're right. There's an infrastructure issue, right? When a parade, whether it's a second lawn or a traditional Mardi Gras parade or an Indian gang, there's a cost there, right? A resource cost.
The reason I bring it up is because there are complaints that the city will go behind a Mardi Gras parade, right? And they'll clean up everything. It'll be like the parade didn't
Fair point,
exist.
Yeah.
Now, the second lines, they may staff it with police that will that know the route and can get you through the route, but they don't staff it with sanitation, and then that doesn't get picked up until Monday. Short-term rentals are very similar in the sense that the city never planned for short-term rentals. Once they figured out how to regulate them, they did it okay.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that they were able to stop the bachelor pads from operating completely.
Right, right.
It just, it kept going. And it was like, look, we want you to come and enjoy our neighborhoods. We love visitors. Nobody here is against tourism. Nobody. What they are against is the city not being able to keep up with this idea that you've got secondary effects from it, right? Mm-hmm. And that happens with Mardi Gras parades. They've kind of figured that out. It happens with second lines. It happens with short-term rentals. It happens with hotels. I mean, the amount of services that this city has to provide just to support the tourism industry is pretty incredible. And the mayor has made a huge push this year that the city doesn't get back what it should, what it's actually bringing to the state. And that's, I understand that frustration. I think New Orleans has always been in this place where it makes Louisiana what it is in many ways, because it's the most unique city in the South. It's the most unique city in America. But if you go to Baton Rouge and you listen to the debates over what should and shouldn't happen in New Orleans, that is often not reflected.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument that the mayor, Mayor Cantrell, who just passed her first year in office, has made with some limited gains, I would say, with Baton Rouge to say, gosh, Louisiana wouldn't be the same place it is without New Orleans and without the economy that comes from the tourism. I also think it's an interesting layer that you bring up about the trash, for instance, and Mardi Gras. It is amazing if you've never seen it. I think we've talked about it on the show, how quickly after a parade, the street cleaners come in and a crew of people comes in, and 15 minutes after the fire truck passes signaling the end, it's 95% picked up. It's amazingly efficient. But you are right that a second line, and when we're talking about second lines for listeners, we're talking about the traditional Sundays by the neighborhood groups, as opposed to the second lines you might see that somebody hires a jazz band to follow a wedding procession on a Friday night. But those neighborhood second lines, which run, 7 or 8 months a year now on Sundays usually, there is no organization responsible for picking up the trash. At least not until Monday. But
But these happen. So
not
the,
in real
the
time.
So the neighborhoods have to
deal with it.
Deal with it all, you know, the rest of the day, Sunday. Mm-hmm. There's also, it's not just second lines. I mean,
sure.
Look, nobody should be surprised that we party pretty hard here on the weekends. every week of the year, it always happens, right? Now, how does this stuff get cleaned up? If you party, there is going to be trash.
Sure.
And there are bars that attract big parties out in the streets. We allow drinking in the streets here. That's going to generate trash. How does that all, how do you manage that as a city? Not just, that's not a tourism issue. That's just
an infrastructure.
Hey, we just like to party, right? How are we going to manage that? And the mayor, to her credit, has recognized that it should be a cleaner city than it is. We should do a better job at cleaning stuff up. But there's a huge cost to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, sanitation is able to clean up after the Mardi Gras parades because they are funded to do that, because it's a major tourist attraction. It's always been recognized as such. But it's never. But now that we have this year-round tourism industry, we're getting back to that whole theme of the year. You know, we now have year-round tourism industry that puts pressure on city services. We now have we have always had year-round partying. So when you put those two together, the strain on city services is so great that it is impossible to think with our level of funding that you're going to be able to clean it all up, that you're going to be able to address the needs of every resident. And one of the things that I think short-term rentals has brought up an interesting debate about is that they've been looked at as a potential source for revenue. And of course, they have been a source of revenue since they were legalized in 2016, because before that, nobody was paying a
Sure.
Single dime on taxes. And it was sure. like, oh, well, they're paying it in sales tax. No, that's not enough. They were putting the hotels really at a disadvantage because the hotels are paying taxes. All those uh-huh. tourists were uh-huh. paying taxes on a room tax, and nobody was paying it on Airbnb or on short-term rentals. Now those taxes are being paid. They just passed a bill that raised the level of taxation for the short-term rentals to the same as hotels, which should help the city sort of equalize that market. But when you start relying on short-term rentals for taxes, how are you ever going to address the needs of residents who say, wait a second, we shouldn't have as many short-term rentals, especially when you need that funding for so many different things in the city? I mean, the mayor really is under a unique amount of pressure in terms of her budget. I think it's tough being mayor when you start looking at all those numbers. It's easier when you're on council and you don't have to look at the day-to-day. But, I mean, the mayor's job in some ways is that they just have to, like, kind of say, no, we don't have the money for it a lot. And that's pretty frustrating. I think the former mayor, Mitch Landrieu, said that if we could just get $150 million more a year, like, the city would run like clockwork. It would be amazing. All the trains would run on time. All the trash would get picked up. We'd get it all done. But, you know, that is not reality. We are, in his view, $150 million short. And even when you do great on tourism and even when the Airbnbs proliferate and all of that stuff, you're still not getting the money that you need to make this a great place for residents all the time. Council members talk to me a lot about that this is a city that's hard to live in because your street floods and your car gets wrecked by the flood, or your sewage and water board bill is ridiculous. And there's just all these little things that make you crazy when you're in the city. And I think that may fuel some of that, like, short-term rental tourism resentment debate where it's like, oh, you guys get to see all the fun stuff and you guys get to enjoy it. You don't have to deal with sewage and water board. You don't have to deal with your streets flooding in the middle of August, right?
Yeah. You know, I think New Orleans has always been a hard place to live. It got a whole lot harder after Katrina. But the trade-off always was, well, when it's good, on a good day, it's so much better than a great day almost anywhere else, right?
It's magical.
It is. And it's a hard, it sounds cliche, but it, you know, you get a wonderful afternoon or you got so many choices to do so many things, walking right out your front door, that it has always sort of been worth the internal calculation of, yeah, I got to watch I don't destroy my car when I pull out into the pothole and I, you know, all the things you just described. And that's both what makes it charming and infuriating, right, at times. I think as you talk, more and more what comes to mind is infrastructure, right? All of these things just put more and more stress on an infrastructure that's already taxed, stressed. And that's a common theme across the country. But it gets really bad in a place where you're attracting people. You're putting more weight on top of a crumbling infrastructure.
And I think one of the things that the tourists that come to New Orleans don't get to see is when you get out into some of the neighborhoods that aren't in the historic core, and you start mm-hmm. seeing the illegal dumping and the tires and the stuff that just gets ignored. And it's not because it's a outlying neighborhood necessarily.
Right.
It's because there's just so much need in the city, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, if you're in a historic core neighborhood, you're much more likely to have neighbors who are like, that tire has got to go and I'm calling sanitation to pick it up. But if you're in a neighborhood where there has been, has not fully rebuilt and there's abandoned places that are, you know, nobody's mowing the grass, nobody's taking care of that abandoned house, it's a magnet for some of that stuff that, you know, shouldn't go on in the city, but does.
Sure. And in many ways, that's a legacy of Katrina, where you still have very much in the city core or not very far out, you still have abandoned properties and if not outright blight, then just vacant lots where houses used to be.
I'll give you a great example. Lower Ninth Ward, bastion of black home ownership, probably the highest rate of black home ownership before Katrina. A lot of that got wiped out just because mm-hmm. the whole place got flooded. So you've got a ton of vacant lots there. And the infrastructure issues down there are challenging.
Yeah.
I went down there. I couldn't believe this. I mean, I was doing a story on illegal dumping, and I realized, wait a second, there's a whole other story to be done because people were stealing catch basin covers to scrap them for metal. I mean, to go into that to live in that neighborhood and to already be dealing with the illegal dumping, to already have lost all your neighbors, and then somebody has to steal the catch basin covers on top of that? I mean, are you joking? It was a huge hole in front of the high school. I mean, there's kids getting dropped off on buses right next to a gigantic hole because somebody stole the catch basin cover. That is demoralizing. That's frustrating. That makes the city hard to live in. And it doesn't make New Orleans feel very magical when you're dealing with something like that.
Yeah. I recently did, maybe back in January 2019, I did an episode with Councilwoman Cindy Nguyen, who has, interestingly, the 9th Ward and New Orleans East. And it makes it a very diverse population. You have a large Vietnamese population in New Orleans East. You have a large African-American population in both areas. And one of her drumbeats is about that, is about, hey, we maybe don't get a lot of attention. We're not the tourist place, but there are lots of people living here, and there are these infrastructure issues. Blight, I think about just the other day, they tore down what once was a vibrant movie theater, and all those challenges about rebuilding that. And those places don't get the attention because they're not where tourists are going, right? To kind of drive back to
But they certainly deserve the attention.
Absolutely.
I mean, New Orleans East is a great example because it's the most diverse. It's not a neighborhood. It's an area of the city that's made up of many neighborhoods. But some of those neighborhoods, I mean, you've got a huge Vietnamese population living out there. We went out for I had some friends in town, and we went out for the Tet Festival out there.
It's amazing.
I mean, it is different. It's not like any festival. And when you get out there, you got to take a long Uber ride. I think we spent $30 on Ubers. But, like, I mean, it is totally unique and totally different. And it may not feel like New Orleans, but it's certain when you get out there, you're like, oh, wait, this is New Orleans. Like, this is New Orleans, even though you're so far out of what people think of as New
Orleans. Right. It's amazing. And I should mention, we'll put show notes over at beyondbourbonst.com/92. And we'll reference the one we did with Cindy because we talked about that. They have this incredible wet market out there. The Tet Festival is incredibly family friendly and such a sort of unexpected delight, I guess. And that's one of the things they keep promoting. She keeps promoting. Obviously, it's her district, but there's a lot of things out there. They've recently renovated. There's a small airport out on Lakeshore Boulevard most people don't know about, and there's a restaurant there in the terminal, if you will. It's very Art Deco. It's great. So there's a lot there.
Not a lot of short-term rentals, though.
No, not a lot of short-term rentals.
Like I said, I mean, it's a hard area to get to.
Sure.
Unless you are driving a car, and that is not the most attractive thing for many reasons.
Right.
I mean, if you live in New Orleans East and work on a Canal Street hotel, it is super hard to get to work. That is a problem. People that work in hotels need to be able to live near the hotels, and that's not happening. And New Orleans East is a great place, but it's just not easy to access for workers, for tourists, for a lot of people. And look, access is a major issue when it comes to trying to support this tourism industry. And it's the tourists may be able to pay for access. The people that work in the industry are not able to do that.
Right. And I think that's one of the central issues in this issue, right? I should have also mentioned that the podcast itself is sponsored by a small local hotel, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I do also see a place for short-term rentals. But these points you're bringing up are all the kind of factors that New Orleanians, you know, if you're not in New Orleans and you're thinking about, oh, well, what's the big deal? These are kind of the factors, both on the positive side as well as the negative. You know, from my lens, if someone rents out an extra space, then that's a good thing all the way around, right? If it keeps my neighbor in her home, she's a retiree, so much the better. Now, if she all of a sudden left and wanted to rent out her entire house, that would be a different issue for me.
Well, if you want to talk about it from a policy issue,
sure.
I mean, I think that's exactly where we've landed.
Is right.
That, yeah, it's fine if you want to rent out a spare room, which is kind of how Airbnb started.
Mm-hmm.
They always pitched it that way. In New Orleans, we have the concept of the double, which where I grew up is a duplex, but but the double is a double shotgun or some other form of housing where you've got basically equal sides to the house. And a lot of people will buy the house as a double, will either convert it to a single, or in the Airbnb short-term rental debate, they are just renting out the other side. And
mm-hmm.
we've landed at a spot where we say that's fine.
Right.
Even the double, which technically, some of the purists would say, wait a second, you could rent out that double as a long-term rental,
sure,
that other side of your double, and so you're still taking something off the market. But that's not where we've landed. We've landed at the spot where if it's owner-occupied and it's in the middle of the neighborhood, it's okay. And then the commercial areas that have some housing in them, which I think most of it, it's going to shake out as being large multifamily stuff in the Central Business District and the Warehouse District and some of these core areas where the larger buildings have proliferated. Mm-hmm. They're saying we're going to allow that, and maybe we're going to cap it in a larger building, maybe at like 25 out of a certain size building.
Sure.
Now, that is like a happy medium, but people are by no means like totally on board with this,
right?
Because even with an owner-occupied house, you've still got short-term rentals allowed in residential areas. It's the whole home rental that's been the sticking point, where it's an out-of-town investor who's build, you know, mm-hmm, even if it's an in-town investor, people just don't like the idea that you can buy multiple,
right,
things no matter where and turn them into a little mini hotel. So from a policy perspective, I think we are at a point where serious investors are no longer looking for those whole home, because mm-hmm, it's going to be almost impossible to operate them legally.
Right. And where we stand now is essentially there's no short-term rentals allowed legally in the French Quarter. The council recently passed a ban in the Garden District.
Which I thought it was interesting. I mean, the Garden District ban is interesting,
yeah,
from the perspective that, like, it did not attract short-term rentals the way that the French Quarter did. I mean, if you looked on a map at any point in time, there were very few short-term rentals operating in the Garden District.
Yes.
The historic precedent for saying that the Garden District should not have short-term rentals is that they've tried to limit bed and breakfasts in the Garden District just because people did not want these beautiful historic homes becoming these little tourist things back in the day, and
sure,
certainly they don't want them now with the short-term rental debate coming. But I think the thing that I thought was interesting about Lower Garden District, or the whole Garden District really, is that the Garden District is under incredible pressure tourist-wise.
Mm-hmm.
But the residents there have learned to live with it. This is what they said at the hearing. We've learned to live with it because, yeah, we may have walking tours all day. We may have swarms of tourists getting dropped off by buses at Lafayette Cemetery. But at night, they all go home. That mm-hmm. didn't happen in the French Quarter. It hasn't ever. Nobody goes home at night in the
right.
French Quarter, ever. And so the French Quarter, I think, felt the pressure 24 hours a day. Garden District is more like, look, we'll put up with it. We know it's a beautiful neighborhood. We're happy to share it. Just please, when it gets dark, go home.
I thought my take on it was the Garden District is full of wealthy people. You know, it's you know, probably the highest concentration of mansions in the country in a neighborhood in a city. And it sort of, to me, just felt like a little bit of tagging on, if you will. You know, I see the argument for people that lived in the French Quarter, people that live in the Marigny, the Bywater, the Treme, Mid-City, the Ferret Corridor, all those things. But to me, the sort of, it just feels different to me. It feels a little bit like, well, this is, you know, wealth saying, just kind of stay out of my neighborhood. We tolerate you during the day. It's not disrupting people's ability to live in the people that can afford to live in the Garden District can afford to live in the Garden District.
I don't think anybody said we're banning it in the Garden District because it's a problem. They're saying it's a preemptive ban,
yeah,
right? It's like,
and that's interesting. You know,
that's what it made it interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you could argue whether it was necessary or not.
Right.
I don't know how much you'd come up with there.
Right. And so that's kind of where we're at now with the city. You know, there was recently some changes, and then they'll be up for debate again. So we're recording this in late May 2019, and it'll come back up, I think, in June or July before the council.
They have 90 days to adopt the ordinance. There's a whole lot of open questions about this. I mean, look, the council, we talked about the policy mm-hmm. implications and the money side of this. One of the things that the council really thought that they'd be able to do with these regulations is to try to add more money for affordable housing. Right now they pay, if you stay in a short-term rental in New Orleans, $1 a night goes toward our housing fund, which helps subsidize affordable housing. They thought they might be able to increase that to like $8 with a goal of doing $20 million a year. I mean, it was only generating like maybe $500,000
okay.
with the dollar a night fee. Well, now that they've equalized the tax rate with the hotels, how can you increase that affordable housing fee and not make them less competitive than hotels? That's the argument from the industry. If they try to add more in affordable housing fees to short-term rentals, they're going to have a massive fight on their hands. And that's the fight that has not yet been had. The framework that they adopted says nothing about affordable housing. It says nothing about caps on large buildings. It says nothing about if you develop a housing complex and finance it by saying it's going to be 25% short-term rentals, how much of that also needs to be affordable housing and set that at an affordable rate. Even though the city has already adopted regulations that say if you develop a regular housing complex, whether or not it has short-term rentals in certain areas, you're going to have to make some of those affordable. And that these are policies that cities across the country are dealing with. So I just say that as a cautionary note that it's like, look, we've got a framework in place for short-term rentals that people seem to be in consensus on, but I think the real fight's going to be over the affordable housing stuff.
Well, and you already, we had a friend stay with us earlier this week. They spent one night in an Airbnb, and what they found was instantly in the last few weeks, the cleaning fee has gone way up. Because, again, this is the market trying to react, right? Rightfully or wrongly, the Airbnb operator is simply saying, well, if I'm going to get taxed over here on this thing, on the actual rental, I'm just going to jack up the fees I charge, which probably come straight to me, and Airbnb gets a different cut or no cut. The city probably doesn't get a cut of that. And so it is like squeezing the balloon, right? There's always unintended consequences, which gets back to policy and public sentiment. You can never design the perfect policy that's going to take care of every eventuality.
Well, at a certain point, the tourist is going to vote with their feet, right?
Right.
If the hotel is cheaper to stay in than the Airbnb, and you're trying to get here on a busy weekend, like, where are you going to stay? You know, you're not going to pay more for a short-term rental just to be in a historic neighborhood. Some people will, but, you know, if you're here on a bachelor weekend, and the hotel's cheaper, like, which one are you going to choose? And that's what I think the industry fears, is they always kind of had that advantage. In some ways, you could think about it like Amazon used to have that advantage, because remember back in the day, like, you didn't have to pay sales taxes when you ordered from Amazon. So you could order a refrigerator off of Amazon, save $100 in sales taxes, right? Well, you can't do that anymore. So now they've got to be competitive with each other. I think the hotels and the short-term rental industry are going to start grappling with that. And if they start getting into this stuff where it's like, let's lean on short-term rentals because they've been a source of taxes and revenue in the past, let's lean on them harder than we're leaning on hotels, that's going to be a big fight that the city's going to have to grapple with.
Well, and you've just provided me a nice segue, since we are sponsored by a hotel. So we'll take a moment and talk about the old number 77 hotel. Hey, y'all. I want to tell you about the old number 77 hotel. It's a place I've recommended frequently. It's in a great location in the Warehouse District, just 3 blocks from the French Quarter. It's close to lots of great places to eat and drink, and it's near the streetcar lines, too. I love that they have a wide range of choices when it comes to rooms. Really something for everybody. They have these interior rooms for when you don't want any hint of daylight after a long night out. They also offer premium rooms and artist loft suites that are curated by local New Orleans artists. There's a ton of choices for a small hotel. And another thing I really love is that they support local artists and artisans by exhibiting their works and selling their products, including Sweet Olive Soap Works, Nola Boards, and Chop Industries, 3 businesses all owned by women and featured on this podcast in the past. Oh, and the hotel's pet-friendly, too. As if all that wasn't enough, they have an award-winning restaurant, Compare Le Pen. And besides great food, they have terrific cocktails. In fact, the bar is one of my favorite places to meet out-of-town listeners. The old number 77 hotel is located at 535 Chapatula Street. Use code BBOLD77 when you book a room and save 25%. Plus, you get a little bit of lagniappe, a little something extra, in the form of a $10 credit at Tootlaw for coffee and stuff in the morning. All right, let's get back to our discussion. My takeaway from listening to you here for 45 minutes is this idea about, you were just talking about the Airbnbs or the short-term rentals versus the hotels. We very much had that experience with the food trucks, right? So food, or you're talking about Amazon and the no tax. Well, food trucks become a thing nationwide, come to New Orleans. And, you know, if you were a restaurant owner, my family used to own a restaurant, you would rightfully argue, well, they aren't paying the same rates. They aren't paying, right? They don't have some of the infrastructure costs that we have. So then we start to squeeze that and try to figure it out. But like so many of these policy issues, it's not black and white. There's always unintended consequences. And there's a net good, probably. There's a goodness about having being able to order from Amazon or being able to stay in an Airbnb or being able to buy food from a food truck or from the back of somebody's car at a second line, for that matter. But there's also this other side, right? I think it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. And then there'll be some other pressure on the infrastructure, right, as we go forward. What do you see as the next thing? I guess the next thing will be the sort of fight in 90 days to see what shakes out of the policy and where we go.
I think that they're going to really need to figure out how to do something big on affordable housing in New Orleans. I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunity here in the Central Business District. If you look at a lot of the multifamily buildings, there's some pretty large ones that followed the urban trend of people thinking that it's okay to live downtown again. It's, you know, cities are not something to be feared. Cities are healthy. Cities are great places to live. I think the Central Business District has benefited from that. But then once those apartment buildings got redeveloped for residents, then the short-term rental platform started to take them over, right? So we've got a lot of apartment buildings in the Central Business District, which are, you know, you can legitimately say on your advertisement that it's walking distance to the French Quarter, and that's a big selling point. And you gain a ton of efficiency in having all these people in one place as far as the services and things that you can provide. How much of those buildings, though, need to be set aside for renters who are working within walking or biking distance of where they live? I don't think it's sustainable to say, okay, this part of the city is for tourists, and all you residents, I mean, you might as well just say everybody move to Metairie, you know, and then we'll just bus you in so that you can go to your low-paying job. I mean, it's just... that makes no sense from a policy perspective. I don't think anybody would advocate for that. So I think the council is going to be under a lot of pressure to look at the areas that are on transit hubs, the streetcar line, improve bus service to the point that it's reliable, fast, and frequent, hopefully, and make sure that people have access to jobs, even if they're low-paying, that they can live and enjoy New Orleans exactly the same way that tourists enjoy it when they're not working, right? I mean, is it right? Is it just to expect anything less? I mean, I think the advocates for affordable housing really kind of have the upper hand there. I think, and we certainly have a city council that is, if not activist, they're certainly active. And I think they feel a huge amount of pressure to make sure that the affordable housing situation does not get out of control. Like a city like San Francisco, where wealth just becomes so overwhelming that it becomes not just an impossible place to live, but a terrible place to live, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think anybody who loves New Orleans and visits here or lives here can imagine a New Orleans that's a horrible place to live or a terrible place to live. It's still a great place to live. It should continue to be that way, and it should be that way for people at every income level. I mean, it's... the health of American cities have always been based on that. And luckily, we have a lot of people here, including elected officials, that have not lost sight of it.
Yeah, that's a really great insight. Kevin, I thank you so much for helping us see the nuances and the complexities. It on the surface may feel like a really simple issue, but it's not at all. And there's many facets to it. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share that with us today. We will make sure that we link up to you on Twitter and Instagram and at NOLA.com. I will put all that in the show notes over at beyondbourbonst.com/92. And for those of you listening, thanks for joining us today. If you want to continue to help the show grow, you can become a part of it by joining the crew on Patreon. You can go to beyondbourbonst.com/Patreon.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone who loves New Orleans. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.